Hello, and welcome to episode 108 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav, and with me, as always...
Hello, I'm Ben Chandler, also known as 304. How are you this Friday,
Francisco Gonzalez? I'm doing well, Benjamin Chandler. How are you?
I'm also doing well. I had a good week. I finished up... Mostly finished up. There's a couple of little incidental things, but I finished up all the character animations and all of the background stuff for the biggest section yet in Unavowed. So
that's good. Yeah, it's taken you a while. The last few times I've spoken with you and asked you how work is going, you've said, I'm almost finished with this section of Unavowed. I am very close to being finished with this section of Unavowed.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's, you know, a big bit and you're always sort of setting yourself little milestones.
Yeah, those sorts of things always take time. I mean, I just I decided this week to take another step in my attempts to become more organized. I started off by trying to set a consistent bedtime and waking up time, and you know, putting in a certain amount of hours every day of work, which I had been doing before, but it was all over the place. Like, I'd work well into the night and like go to sleep late and wake up late and stuff. So I decided to get up at a reasonable time and work at a reasonable time throughout the day. But this week I decided to start making myself to-do lists, as you do. And it's helped, even though I haven't really been able to knock out a to-do list in one day because things take longer than you expect, especially when you're doing art stuff like I'm doing. So, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, most of the time I can set myself goals because I do it, you know, I do fairly similar stuff most of the time. Most of the time I can set a series of goals that I know, all right, this is a fair day's work. This is 8 hours of work, you know, and, but I do most of my, I work better in the morning. You tend to favor working at night. I work better in the morning. You know, I usually don't jump on Skype till around 9 o'clock or, you know, around then. And the first, when it's all quiet and everything like that, the first few hours of the morning, I usually, that's when I get most stuff done. And then by lunchtime, I'm sort of looking at my to-do list and going, all right, well, what have I, you know, have I done enough or do I need to really push myself this afternoon? So, you know.
Yeah, it's good to, I've found it's good to like, if I wake up at about 9:30 and I start working anywhere between like 10:30 and 11, and usually until about 1 o'clock when I have lunch, and then I take a break for lunch, and then I get back to it for a little bit, and then like I'll try and work until about 6 or 7. And then I've been trying to have my evenings free, but it's actually, this week was weird because I actually did have most of my evenings off. I stopped working early because I had to go out a few times and like spend evenings elsewhere. So this week was a fluke. But next week I'm going to try and be done by like 6 or 7 and then just enjoy the rest of my evening.
That's the thing about working regular hours, you know. If you sort of do the indie thing, I guess it's not an indie thing, but you know, the fun thing where you're like, oh, I'll sleep in thing, and I'll start work at, you know, midday,
right?
And then yeah, I can work all night. But if you want to go and do stuff, you kind of have to stop work by 5 o'clock. And
it's true because that's when society stops work.
Yeah, that's when events happen, you know. And so for me, you know, depending on circumstance, if I can, I like to start at 7 or 7:30 and sort of, you know, put in a big morning and then just, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, that way, if you work an 8-hour day, you can be done by 3.
Yeah, although I like to have a break in the middle, you know, and recharge and sort of, you know, just get, because by the time I have lunch about 12 o'clock, I'm usually pretty tuckered out. So I have a bit of a break and, you know, just recharge the batteries. And people say to me, you know, how do you play so many games? Like, you know, well, there's a lot of factors. You know, obviously I don't have kids or, you know, that sort of stuff. But also, like, I don't have to commute. So when I was commuting, that would be up to, you know, some days that was 5 hours of my day was just in a car.
Right.
Like, you know, just, whereas I don't have that anymore. And I used to work 7:30 to 5:30. So, you know, I'd leave 5:30 and I'd sort of from home and I'd get home 7:30. And by that time I really had not much energy. So, you know, now I'm like, I don't have to do any of that. I can, I turn off the computer. I go and, you know, cook some dinner, do a few chores, and then I got all the time in the world. So that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
It's also important to take weekends. But yeah, we've...
It's just because you get, like, by Friday night, I'm usually worn out. Like, that's a lot of work to draw all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Monday morning, I'm super fresh, and I get heaps done on Mondays. But, you have that weekend off, you come back fresh. Obviously, it's different for, like, you know, where most of our listeners don't do this as their job.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's different for us.
So, who's our audience? We don't know. But
just ourselves.
Self-care is important, as they say.
Yeah, so. you gotta have a break, and plus a break recharges you, and you're not putting out below par, you know, content because you're like, oh, I gotta keep making. You're like, you come back, you're fresh, and you're doing stuff with energy and enthusiasm, which makes a lot. Well done.
Sorry, that was just that just came out. So we have a very special episode today. Well, it's not really a special episode. It's more like a special day, I guess. Today, as of this recording, this episode will be up tomorrow, but it's June 9th today. And that means that it is exactly 5 years ago today that we started doing this podcast.
My gosh.
And we've only done 108 episodes in 5 years. But that's fine, because...
Yeah, but we've had about, it's not 14 about quant- we've had about 14 episodes worth of content.
That's true. That's true. So, I just saw recently that some people who shall remain nameless, but whose names are Gunnar Harbo, started listening to us in episode 100. Hi, Gunnar.
You've got the worst definition of nameless I've ever encountered.
Hey, I played Planescape Torment. Okay, I don't know what that has to do with anything.
No.
but so. We have, he pointed out that, like, we don't ever really anticipate having any new listeners, and that's kind of true in a way, so I guess we should maybe think about new listeners. So if this is your first episode, welcome to the podcast, and also, if you've been listening since day one, which, God bless you if you have, you might want to... Well, one, get a life, and two, stick around until the very end of this episode, because we will have a couple of little treats for you.
For the long time fans.
Yeah, a little reward for the long time fans. Now, having said that, if you haven't listened
imagine though, if they've been listening for 107 and 0.1 episodes, and then they got to this point, and they're like, oh, this is enough, and they didn't stick around to the end of this one just to hear the little treats. Like,
that would be kind of a shame, but, you know, life is full of disappointments, isn't it?
It would also be very unlikely, that's all I'm saying.
That's true.
Anyway.
Also, if you haven't listened to us from the very beginning, and you're curious about what these little... You're feeling left out, and you're curious about what these treats at the end might be, it's at your own discretion. You've been warned. We used to do very different things on our podcast in the early days. Anyway.
You've just given it all away. Anyway, let's go.
Oh, I haven't given a thing away. No one knows anything. Anyway.
Only me. I really underestimate the intelligence of our listeners. Other than the fact that they listen to our podcast.
If they've listened to our podcast for 107 episodes, they're not intelligent.
Yeah, a clear aberration in their normal daily wisdom.
Well, if we didn't lose listeners before, we definitely have now. Anyway, let's move on to our topic for this week. Our topic for this week was actually suggested to us by Mr. Underhill, who is working on Gibbous, a Cthulhu adventure, which looks very interesting.
Also known as Livyu.
Yes, right, Livyu. Ah, yes, okay. So that explains why I'm friends with him on Facebook.
Oh my god!
I get all these random friend requests.
Oh, I'm so popular.
No, it's not that. I get friend requests on Facebook, and I don't know who they are, so I have to look and see who our mutual friends are. And if it's like a bunch of game dev people, then I'm like, okay, this must be a game dev person, so I'll approve them. But then I forget who they are by name. So like, I'm like, oh, look, this person did this. Who is that again? And then, okay, so anyway.
That wasn't our topic, that bit, no, by the way. That wasn't the
topic. I lost my train of thought thinking about Facebook anomalies. So Mr. Underhill, who's working on Gibbous, a Cthulhu adventure, which looks very nice. I said interesting before, but it also looks cool. It's
incredibly smooth animation and like high-res graphics. It's very impressive how much work has gone into that thing.
Yeah. So he asked us about readability, and I posted his question into the Skype chat.
Mm-hmm.
Let me look at it.
I have to say, as far as topic suggestions go, this one is, I love this topic. This is right up my alley. So thank you very much for the suggestion.
It's good. That means I don't have to talk very much this podcast.
Oh my, come on.
All right. So he says, I think readability would make for an interesting podcast. And by that, I mean stuff from signposting and visually cluing in the player to actual visual readability using contrast, balance of textures and details. Basically, what is needed to communicate with the player in a clear and aesthetically pleasing fashion. So, I can think of offhand, off the top of my head, a very classic example of readability in games.
You go on.
And I'll throw it out there just as an example, and we can continue the discussion. But one thing that I've noticed in games, and I can't think of what games right now. I can think of the example, but not what games use it. But, using a spotlight to direct your attention to something, like a door, for example. Okay, well, there you go.
Well, there's an example I wrote about recently on Adventure Games, where you have Monkey Island 2, you have the doorway where you have to do the hand, so if this is 3, this, you know, what's this?
Yes.
And that's very clearly a beam of sunlight coming down and directly lighting that door up and leaving most of the rest of the scene in shadow. So that's a really good example of spotlighting.
That is definitely a good example of spotlighting. But I wonder if, I mean, in that particular example, there isn't really much else to interact with in the alley.
But when that scene was painted, they didn't know what the scene was for. Like, the scene hadn't been designed yet.
Right.
And there's lots of crates and boxes and stuff around, because Guybrush needs to hide.
Right.
But yeah, so that's one visual example. That's a good example of, like, you know, directing. I mean, I've been writing about this over on Adventure Gamers, so, you know.
Yeah. I think one of the Batman Arkham games, or all of them, did this, where it's like, if you're walking around in an area and there's a door that you need to go through, there'll be a light above it or shining on it or whatever. But yeah, using a light to direct the player's attention to something that they need to interact with is definitely a good starting point for readability. But I'll let you talk about this, since you're the expert.
Well, there's a couple of moments, I guess, in my game developing and playing career that really let me, I guess, understand how directing the player can be done in a fun way or an interesting way or in a salvation way, in a salvaging way. Like, a bit doesn't read very well, so how do we fix this? Probably the first one was being a kid playing Doom, and, you know, I forget exact examples, but, you know, there's secret doors, you know, and stuff like that. There's one part where you've got, I think it's health potions arranged in the form of an arrow. And, you know, you see this arrow on the floor and you're like, oh, that's cool, you know. And there was a very obvious moment to me where, like, oh, the designer of this level is telling me, go there. There's something to do there, you know. And that was a pretty cool moment for me where you're like, oh, you can actually tell the player this is where they need to go with, you know, more subtle hints than go this way. You know, these days we follow auto maps and stuff, not just auto map. That's such an old school term, a mini map. You've got a blip on the radar and you follow that, you know, but
someone's been playing Descent.
Yeah, I've been playing Descent and Ultimate Underworld 2, both of which are very much auto-map games. But yeah, so that was probably the first moment. And, you know, secret doors, there'll be a secret door that's a different color to the rest of the wall, and you see this one panel that's a slightly different color, and you're like, oh, I got to hit that. There's some armor behind there or something like that. So as a kid, that was where I first noticed readability being a thing, you know. And I remember being stuck in Sam and Max Hit the Road when you're at the Bigfoot feast and there's the door that goes back into the kitchen. I couldn't see that door in that background. And it took me, I was stuck there for so long just because I couldn't see this door. So that was a big frustration for me that I'd been stuck in this game for quite a while because there were a lot of locations to visit, you know, and I thought I'd missed something obvious. So I was going everywhere and I just missed a stupid hotspot. And then I remember reading a blog post by Josh about Gemini Rue and some of the challenges he faced and stuff. And he was talking about in this particular post how some testers had struggled to notice one of the room exits, which caught my attention because I remembered Sam and Max and how much frustrating that was for me.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a room exit sort of going down. It was a funny little place to have a room exit. And the way he'd drawn it was very hard to see. So he was trying to figure out, how can I make it so that people say, oh, I have to go down there. And what he did was do a trail of blood leading down this sort of pathway. So you see the trail and it stands out. You know, there's a lot of blue scenery in that game. So
I know, I think trails. I know exactly what scene this is.
Yeah, it's right near the end. And and I remember reading that and thinking, oh, that's an interesting idea. You know, it's a contrasting thing in a blue, I think it was probably, it's a long time since I've played that game, but a blue scene, you've got this dark red blood that obviously stands out very well.
Right.
And to me, that was a very smart way of saying, hey, you can follow this trail. It's leaving a trail of breadcrumbs, effectively.
Breadcrumbs.
Yeah, well, you know. But it's that same sort of thing of we like to follow a line. We like to follow a trail. We like to follow a pathway. And you don't have to have an actual pathway, you can suggest it by something like that, you know. So that was a really, those were the sort of the two things that really made me, well, I guess three if you count Sam and Max and the door that I missed. Those are the three things that really made me think, hey, readability is super important in scenery. Yeah. This is a very important issue because, you know, I talk about sort of how to make a background pretty a lot of the time, but a really big and important part of doing a background isn't just making it pretty and atmospheric and immersive, but also playable and functional.
Mm.
And, you know, it's very important to have that sense of readability and that sense of contrast and signposting. And, you know, it's interesting the range of clues. A big one is contrast. I love the use of contrast. You know, you've got a dark room, but you can see the doorway because you can see the light coming in from outside. So that strong contrast of the light from outside really shows, hey, there's the door, even though it's a dark, shadowy scene.
Right.
And I think that's, I don't want to say it's the most important thing, but if a player can't play your scene, it doesn't matter how good it looks, it's a failure.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's pretty fair to say, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
we're making games, not paintings.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the example that comes to mind from a personal standpoint is the marketplace scene in Shardlight. We had some trouble with readability in that.
Yeah, we had to do about four or five different changes for readability.
Yeah, and I think it was a combination of factors, but ultimately, the issue was that there's the bell that you have to shoot with your crossbow, and a lot of people didn't see the bell, and so like you went as far as like putting a giant striped post on the bell to draw attention to it, and people still didn't see it. Like there's still people who miss it because there's just so much detail in that scene.
Well, an interesting thing to remember about that particular scene is I painted that scene before there was any design at all.
That's true, yeah.
There was no design for that. So I just put in lots of interesting details.
Right.
Because I was having fun with this setting and everything like that. And then later on, we're like, all right, well, we'll put this in here. We'll put that in there. And
right.
That naturally, when you paint a scene where the gameplay has already been designed, you naturally sort of signpost stuff, I guess. Well, not naturally, you consciously do it. But right. If you don't have a design in place, you can't do that. So that makes it a lot harder.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one reason why it's very helpful to have a design pretty much in place before you start drawing.
Yep. excuse me. What about textures?
Well, textures can do a couple of things. Textures can muddy up
not the stay together, that's for sure.
Wah, oh dear.
Wah.
Wow, that's a very obscure musical reference for you. I'm impressed. It is sad music.
Thank you.
Oh.
I know. Anyway, please continue.
To the no other textures fans listening
to this. No one else is gonna understand that, yes.
but yeah, it's interesting because textures are visual noise, and visual noise by definition can confuse the eye. It can be, you know, distracting, it can be misleading, but also what it can do is it can be used sort of as a form of contrast. Any form of contrast is going to draw the eye, you know, and there's a lot of different forms of contrast. One that I've been talking about a lot lately is contrast of density, which is an interesting idea where you have, for example, a big blank wall, and then in one spot you've got 15 tiny little photos stuck on the wall, right? Or in frames on the wall. Where are you going to look?
The frames.
Right. You're going to look at the one spot. So that contrast of density, the density of detail, as it were, is where you're going to look. So if you have a fairly blank sort of wall, but one spot that's heavily textured, you're going to look there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're going to be interested in this is where the detail is. What is that?
Right.
Is this a clue? You know, so that can be used, like anything is a contrast when you've got something that differs from the other, where it's black or white, whether it's red versus green, whether it's bright, you know, whether it's sort of, you know, clean versus dirty, whether it's detailed versus sparse. Mm-hmm. Anything can be used as a contrast. So in that sense, textures can definitely, you know, provide that contrast that will act as signposting.
So I guess one thing to consider too is the fact that if you have a lot of interesting things and you have contrast and textures and stuff, obviously, as we've said, that's going to draw the player's eye. So you have to be conscious of that when composing a scene, in that if there's places that you don't want your player to go to, or you don't want certain things, like you don't want to make certain parts more interesting than the actual thing that needs to be interesting, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. The contrast should be where the focus should be, usually.
Right. You don't want to distract.
In saying that, we do want to explore the scene. We are making adventure games.
Well, yeah, it's true. But I mean, if like there's something very specific that you want the player to do, like if there's something hidden in the scene, you don't want to make everything else in the scene super important so that the player will never think to look at the thing that you want them to discover.
And if you do, there's a couple of things that you can do to draw attention to the thing that you do want them to discover, if the rest of the scene is super detailed.
And what might those ways be, Professor Chandler?
Other than certain types of contrast, you can have a very detailed scene. Like, for example, one example, we'll go back to Shardlight again. You've got the scene where you're outside the reactor tunnel. And you've got, there's a fair bit of detail, but I wanted to highlight the scene as well, is I used a blue light, which wasn't a difference in texture, and it wasn't a difference in, you know, any other form of contrast, but it was something different because of this bright contrast, this blue color in a very drab world. That's why I saved the color blue quite a lot in Shardlight, because I wanted it to be this very specific things. And another thing that you can do is animation. People will always look at the thing that's moving. You can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you have, I've done that before. I remember the Blackwell Epiphany, once you get into the Karth house, there was a note that Dave needed you to look at. I don't even know if this made it into the final game. Anyway, I think it did. It's been too long since I played it. But nobody could see this damn note. And I didn't want to make it bright white because it didn't fit the scene, so I made it blow a little bit in a breeze.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Everyone noticed it straight away because it's moving.
Sure.
So that's a really good way, even if it's a bit of paper blown on a breeze, it's a good way to go, hey, this is important, look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, that's a form of contrast. You've got an entirely static background with one thing moving on it. Mm-hmm. Where are you going to look? You're going to look at the movement. So those sort of things, there's very specific things that draw the eye. The first thing that will always draw the eye is a human face. You can draw any scene of any type whatsoever. If you've got a human face in there, because that's what we care about, that's what we sympathize the most with, we'll always look at the human. It's the most interesting part, you know. We want to see what the human's doing. I guess we're very selfish with our attention spans, but I guess that's how it is.
Says the guy who's typing away while you're talking.
Yeah, but you know.
I'm doing it for a reason, though. Anyway, please continue.
Well, imagine if you're just typing nothing, if you're just making keyboard fun. But yeah, so the act of putting a human in, I always lament this because in my nice little art theory bubble, I like to think that you can draw the attention like this and you can draw the attention like this, and so I put all this thought into how I compose my backgrounds. Then someone will do a preview of the game and take the worst screenshot ever of where the player's standing. And, of course, you always look at the player character first. That's the most interesting part of an adventure game.
Uh-huh.
Because it's the person the whole time. So you look at the player character, and the player character will be standing in some awful spot with no sense of composition and just ruins the scene for me. I know it's the most it's the most pathetic thing to be upset about. But, you know, rule of thirds, people, come on.
It's not really that stuff. It's not something to be you shouldn't be embarrassed to get upset about it, because it's perfectly true. It's like, you know, they're ruining my beautiful work.
Yeah, you know, it's
but
cuz yeah. that's where the eye will look. And this
in saying that, yeah,
this is 100 people's first exposure to that piece of art, and the person standing in the worst spot possible.
I've become a lot more conscious about that ever since I learned about it. And now, like, when I take screenshots, I try and make the player character... I try and position the player character in a way that won't... You know, that'll complement the composition of the scene and not destroy it. Like... Yeah.
It can be a problem if you're like me and you work with rule of thirds and then you want to put your player character in the rule of thirds area, yeah, which blocks off the nice rule of third bit that you just painted.
That's true, yeah. That can happen. But yeah, I'm always conscious to avoid making the player character create a tangent too when I when I take screenshots.
Oof.
But that can be pretty difficult.
But it is. I remember when we announced Shardlight and I made you go back and change, I think, every single screenshot that you were going to use for the announcement. Because I was like, oh, this isn't right and this isn't right. And it was 4 pixels to the left, but it mattered to me, you know.
Yeah. You got to pick your battles.
Yeah, you do. And it is very pedantic. But when you're making a first impression, you want it to be strong, I guess. And when art is your entire role in the game.
It's true, but at the same time, you have to figure that most people who look at these screenshots are going to be impressed by the screenshots overall and not nitpicking about, like, composition things and art stuff. That's stuff you're going to see.
That's very true. Anyway, we should move back to signposting, because this is getting a little derailed, which isn't surprising.
No, it's not surprising. I told you you were gonna have treats like our old podcast.
Yeah. but yeah, so... Another thing that you can do, and this seems really silly, but it's absolutely true, is you can literally use a sign to direct the player's attention. A sign with an arrow is perfect. If you want someone to look at something, put a big old sign pointing to it.
It's true.
It is true.
Or if you want to be a little bit more subtle about it, you can do you can use triangles in your composition to direct the... I mean, it doesn't have to be a sign. It can just be something that's pointy at an angle to kind of lead the eye that way, like an edge of a, I don't know, like a statue's arm or something.
Yeah, a statute. The term that James Gurney has applied to the effect is spoke wheeling, where the
Okay,
spokes of
yeah.
the wheel radiate outwards from the point of interest. So you want things pointing towards that center, the hub of the wheel, I guess, the axle.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the idea, how
Yeah.
accurate that this is, it's very difficult to measure. And James Gurney himself has done sort of studies with scientific people to see where an eye moves or wanders over an image, and it's never as simple as you think. But the idea is that the eye likes to follow lines as a sort of pathway, and if all the lines in an image converge on a single point, no matter where the player begins looking at the image, the first area they'll end up studying is where all those lines converge upon. Now, like I said, it's hard to know exactly how useful that is or how relevant it is, but it's not a bad idea. You know, and another thing is, if you've got lines and sort of arrows that are heading to the outside of your image, if you block them off with a shape, it stops the eye. The idea is that it stops the eye from wandering to that edge of the image. So, you know, and a lot of the times when you see how an image is composed, you want to have the clutter on the outside of the image, not the clutter, the unimportant stuff on the inside. The center of the image is where a player is probably going to start looking at stuff.
Right.
So if you've got interesting and important stuff, it should be near the center, just because that's where we start looking.
Yeah.
And that.
Yeah, I was going to mention on the topic of triangles, and I think I've talked about this before, but for a few backgrounds that I've painted, I've done the thing where I've made a triangle out of the different, like, I've kept one color and made triangles out of it and sort of put the important stuff within that triangle. And I don't know if that's the correct use of triangles, but I tried doing it. And you and I talked about it, but...
Yeah. I mean, that's
one way of doing things. It's not like a... Well, go ahead. What were you going to say?
In terms of, I mean, everyone's got their own theories about what works and what doesn't. Right. So it's hard to say. Like I said, with the spoke wheeling thing, it's hard to measure this stuff.
Yeah.
When I use triangles in composition of that sort, I'm not using it to draw focus. I'm using it to balance stuff out. But
right.
If you've got very obvious focal points, it can be nice to balance those out so that they don't make the image feel lopsided.
Right.
So there's something. Yeah. But yeah, in terms of communication, I think there's a couple of things to keep in mind. And sometimes in art, it's interesting in that I guess you've got various goals that are all at odds with each other. You want to make an image that's very detailed so that a player can explore it with, you know, and not see, oh, there's one door. Okay. You know, at the same time, you want to make it very obvious this is the thing you do, so they're not stuck wandering around 17 rooms going, I don't know what I'm supposed to click. You want to, I think context is very important when you're thinking about this stuff. There'll be certain cases. There's a doctor's office in Shardlight where I went ahead and made it very detailed because the player was going to be stuck in there. And I knew that they wouldn't be able to wander around. And when you've got a place where a player will be stuck for a certain amount of time, I think it's okay to have a lot of detail. I think we talked about this either last episode or a couple of episodes before. If you've got a lot of detail spread across 17 screens, that's a lot harder to cope with as a player.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
So I usually try, if I know the design, I don't always know a design when I'm doing a bit, but if I know the design and I'm in a bit where I'm like, this is where the player's going to be stuck for a certain amount of time, I'll put in as much detail as I can because, you know, there's your chance to, like, you've slowed the player down. They're forced to be here. They're not going to be like, well, I've got 17 screens of clutter to look at. This is going to take me forever. This is frustrating. They're in that one spot so they can look at a lot of stuff, you know. Another thing is clutter and detail isn't a bad thing or isn't too distracting if it's homogeneous, I want to say. So if you paint a very detailed forest with trees, with shrubs and everything like that, but and it's very cluttered looking, but you have the contrast in mind and you keep that in mind and you have one stone in the middle of it that's a different shape or an interesting shape.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter how cluttered you make that scene. If that stone is interesting, they'll look at that stone. And
right.
A lot of this comes down to having an interesting and bold silhouette. Mm-hmm. And by silhouette, I mean the outline of something. If all of your stones are... There's a great example in King's Quest V where you've got the one tree that stands out when you come down the road at the very, very start. And you've got... You know the tree I'm talking about, right?
The one in the screen with the poisonous snake?
Yes.
Yes.
So you've got a screen with about 8 different trees on it.
Yes.
But there's only one tree that you can't look at the other trees.
No, because this one is huge and takes up the most space and also has the most interesting shape.
Exactly. The other trees are just trees. There's nothing to them. You've seen a billion of those trees before in your life. Whereas this particular tree looks weird, looks interesting.
Right.
So you look at it, you know. Mm-hmm. It's all down to contrast. I can't really think of it, you know. And we've got a lot of tools now that we use to help. You know, we have a lot of feedback for the player. So when your mouse is over something, it tells you what that thing is. Things are popping up. Things are happening. You're like, oh, I'm over something I can use.
Right.
You know, if a game doesn't have that, it's very frustrating. We've got things, you like hotspot indicators, where they go, oh, this is the 4 hotspots on this screen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got very modern. Well, they're not all modern, you know. Those solutions have been around for a while. But
sure.
In terms of pure visuals, I think it's all contrast. You know,
that's definitely one thing that I've had to think about a lot in with doing the backgrounds in Lamplight City, because obviously since it's a detective game, you're going to, you know, a big chunk of the gameplay is looking around scenes and, like, you know, looking for stuff. So if I want to have like a really cluttered background, I have to definitely take into consideration that I want to highlight certain areas that are more important than others, because otherwise it's frustrating for the player to be like, oh my God, there's all this stuff. Like, where do I begin? You know, you don't want to overwhelm the player with that sort of thing. But at the same time, you don't want to make it stick out so much that it's like, oh, well, this is obviously the place that I want to do. It's like, you know, the old animation where you know that a door is going to open because it doesn't match the rest of the background?
Mm-hmm. Or in Gabriel Knight, the SVG edition, where only the objects are higher res.
Well, that's different, but that's yes.
Terrible.
It's terrible, but it's slightly different. That's just oversight on the part of the designers.
Well, it's just, yeah, I don't know. But again, well, that's a contrast, and it makes everything really easy to spot.
It's true. It's true. Functionally, it's great, but visually, it's awful.
Yeah. It's interesting. Like I said before, a lot of the times, your art goals will be at odds with each other, you know?
Yeah.
in terms of sort of... Oh, I'm not very... excuse me. I'm not very good at speaking tonight. In terms of sort of... You want to have an interesting-looking scene, and you want to have an object rendered interestingly and placed clearly... But if stuff's not overlapping it, it doesn't feel very natural. Compositions where all the objects are spaced neatly apart from each other just looks, they look so fake, you know. So you have to have things overlapping in order to make it feel natural.
While at the same time avoiding those damn tangents.
Well, yes, that's another, but that's a topic for, that's a very different topic and hard to talk about.
Oh,
but
I know.
It's one of those things where you're always trying to balance. You know, does this look good? Is it playable? Is it detailed enough? Is it too detailed? Does it match the rest of the scenes in the game? Does it need to stand out because this bit's different? You know, this is the scary bit, so I have to make the light red or whatever. You know, there's all these things that you have to balance, and it's always important to remember that playability is number one, no matter what. Practicality comes first, and readability is probably the biggest part of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if, again, it comes down to the idea that if you know your design very well before you paint a scene, you will naturally set it up better for that scene.
Yeah.
You can't, you can't really, because it's hard to change the lighting on a whim.
Oh yeah.
If you've painted the whole scene.
I mean, I've done it midway, but yeah,
it's
It's just kind of a pain in the ass.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, yes, it's a piecemeal fix that works, but if you can avoid having to do it, you know, if you plan carefully, if you think, all right, well, you know, and that's one of the things I really like working with Dave, is that Dave doesn't commit to a scene usually until he knows it all works, and he spends 3 weeks bashing his head against it to make sure it works. So by the time I get to it, I know exactly what's going to happen usually, you know, and that really helps. In other ways, that limits what I'll do artistically. And so, again, you're always at odds with the beauty of a thing versus the practicality of a thing. Mm. And it's the hardest thing in the world to draw an empty scene. And, you know, there's one part in Unavowed where I had to just draw empty rooms. And it's, oh, it's the worst. You know.
Yeah.
But that's necessary for how the game works, you know. You have to think, well, this is... You know, there's certain locations where having a lot of detail does not make sense.
Right. One thing I wanted to touch on, which kind of goes back to the idea of ways to kind of avoid distracting the player unnecessarily, and also to talk about a topic that you wrote about, is foreground objects.
Mm-hmm.
I like using foreground objects, possibly too much, but... I'm really taking advantage of using foreground objects in Lamplight City, and I love putting them in, and I love finding interesting ways to incorporate them. But I've had a couple of problems in the past with a couple of scenes where the foreground objects have been distracting, either because they were too bright or because they were too in the foreground, I guess. So if you're looking to use foreground objects, what's a good way of making sure that they're not too distracting? And because actually one thing that I did that I kind of broke my little self-imposed well, it wasn't really breaking a rule, but it was doing something a little different, was I recently painted a very detailed scene that takes place in a coroner's mortuary or morgue, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I put in a few foreground objects that were interesting, and I realized that they were very interesting, and so to not have them be hotspots was kind of cheap, I felt, so I made them hotspots. That's the only room in the game so far where the foreground objects are hotspots, but I've also played games where the foreground objects, if you look at them, they give a unique description. So it's not unheard of, but yeah.
I think there's a couple of different takes on this that are worth discussing.
But there's also, I should, as a brief aside in my defense, I did do some spotlighting where the important things that you have to interact with, the important areas that you have to interact with, are lit up very much in contrast with the rest of the bits that are dark. So the light indicates the two places you have to, the two spots. Like, one is the spot where the character is, which you're going to click on him anyway because he's a character, but the other one is the area of the room that you can later interact with. But anyway, I interrupted you. Please continue.
I think it's worth noting that there's some scenes where you don't have to do much in.
Right.
And, you know, especially the way Wedgedi and the way you and I have worked and the way, you know, a lot of the sort of games that we do as designers and as artists and stuff like that, there's often a scene where all you got to do in there is talk to a guy. And it reminds me of in Gabriel Knight, you go to a university, fall asleep in a lecture, and then talk to a guy in his office.
Right.
And when you go into that office, he's got these great foreground objects. They're fantastic. Yeah. Not only are they grotesque and interesting, but they're facing basically the player. They're facing against the wall so that we can see them. Those objects are clearly set up not to be looked at.
Right.
Why would they be facing us? They're there for our pleasure, but they're not there for the in-game characters. They're a nice fancy picture frame. That's really all they are. Right. You know? And so in scenes,
however,
like that,
they do have unique descriptions when you look at them.
Right, but the purpose of those is not to be picked up, is not to be pushed,
is not to be taken.
They're for our pleasure, and I think it's right. very obvious in cases like that where this isn't. I'm never going to pick that up. Right, I'm never going right. to do anything with that. So I think it's okay to do that stuff, and it's okay. important to remember that those are a framing element, and that you can, you know, you can direct people with a particular shape, and if you surround things with a frame, you're going to look mm-hmm. at what's in the middle of the frame. So, you know, a lot of adventure games make the foreground objects perfectly black. You know, Day of the Tentacle is the most famous mm-hmm. example.
Mm-hmm.
This works pretty good, you know, because a lot of the times you only need to see the silhouette of a golf club to know it's a golf club.
Sure.
Tells you everything you need to know. You see a silhouette of a potted plant. You see a silhouette of a, you know, grandfather clock. You know what they are. Your mm-hmm. brain fills in the details. You don't need the extra detail.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of different options. There's no perfect solution, and there's no absolutely never do this to either of it, you know. But, yeah, foreground object can be a distraction. But, again, if you know your design, pick your scene, pick your spot where, like, oh, all I got to do in this scene is have a conversation. I'll go wild because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't have to pick up anything else. I remember there's at least one scene in Lamplight City that I've played where you go and I think you visit a moneylender
mm-hmm.
and all you do in there is talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
You don't pick up anything. You don't do anything else.
Yes.
So you, in a scene like that, you can put whatever. You can add right. whatever because you're not going to be missing the key that's on the table or, you know.
Right, right, right.
Anything of that nature. There's no little tiny thing to miss. So. Right. Go wild, you know, if it fits the scene.
Sure.
The fact that he's a moneylender means he's not going to have 60 years worth of junk collected in his building.
Exactly.
You know, so it's one of those things where context is everything in this case.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Yeah. But I think objects.
Yeah, there was another scene that you also played, which is a tailor shop where...
Right.
I played it recently again, and I was like, all you have to do in there is talk to a guy. Mm-hmm. And I had already put in, like, one foreground object and stuff, but I was like, this scene still feels really empty to me. Like, there's stuff happening here, but it just feels really empty. And, like, you know, the main focus is this character in the middle that you're going to click on, so there's really nothing that I have to worry about there. So I went back, and I added... three things, and one was a table, one was a lamp, and the other one was a foreground mirror, and now I think the scene looks great. Like, it's cozy, it's readable, it's got all this stuff, more stuff to look at, and even though I didn't actually make any of them hotspots, so that's a lie. But...
Yeah, but you still look at stuff with your eyes.
Sure, yeah, it feels more... It feels better. I don't know how to describe it other than using that word. It just feels better. Like it.
And I gotta say, like,
yeah.
I gotta say, if you're painting and you're trying to add detail to the scene, and you've painted
what?
60
Sorry?
Scenes for the damn game
painting.
Already.
Sorry.
What's that? Sorry.
You kind of cut off when you said painting, so I was wondering what you said, but then I figured out what you said.
If you're painting away at a scene and you want to add more detail to it, but you've already done 60 scenes for this game and you're trying to get it done and you need to add detail and you got a big blank area, foreground objects are the best thing in the world because they take up so much damn space.
It's true.
That's the best thing about them, man. They're the quickest way to fill up a massive corner of a scene. Be like, oh, what am I going to do here?
Yeah, although when I sketch out a scene, I always take foreground objects into account, and I always think, what's an interesting foreground object I can put into this scene? Because I like to use foreground objects as not only a way to take up space, but also as a nice way to, like, tell the player about what this background is. Like, if a character lives there, it's a great place. A foreground object is a great way to sort of convey who the character is by, like...
Right, all background elements do that, yeah.
Sure, but yeah, foreground objects help too.
Yeah, but like I said, the best thing about them, other than, I mean, they're a great framing device, and they're great at adding depth, and they're great at this, and they're great at that. But the best thing is, if you're feeling lazy, slap a big foreground plan in. It fills it up real quick. Add which a pillow. You know, sure. All of that stuff, you know, in terms of practical stuff. Mm-hmm. And also, I think in the foreground, you can get away with very complex shapes.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one's going to click on it anyway, you know.
Well,
there's a great one. There's a great one that I love in Full Throttle. We're in Malcolm Cawley's office, and it's, you know, there's everything's off in the distance, so it's far. And then you've got this incredibly ornate sort of decoration that's totally there because they obviously said to Peter Chan, "Oh yeah, we only need this little stuff." So he's like, "Well, I got all this space to play. It's fun to have that, you know."
That's the one with all the cherubs and stuff, right?
Oh, yeah, and the Grim Reaper and everything like that.
Right.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And it's, you know, it's obvious that because it's quite a sparsely detailed scene, you've got a desk and a dent in the floor that you've told that you have to use the safe and you know, a scene exit to the right. As well as where you came in from, there's all this space that it's like, well, no one's going to mind if I block this off with lots of detail. The facility of the scene is pretty obvious because there's nothing here, so I can go wild in the corner and just add whatever I want because I'm not, you know, distracting from the signposting.
Did I show you or tell you about the Easter egg in that scene?
Yes.
Okay. Did I show you? Were you still here?
Yes, but that's not really relevant to the discussion.
It's not, but I like it.
Okay. Yep. But yeah, it's one of those things where, again, Peter Chan obviously knew the design of the scene.
Sure.
And went, here's my chance to add lots of different detail without worrying about distracting the player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, yeah. I know that I have a lot more to say on this topic because it's one of those things that's hard to demonstrate with words. Orally, it's not a very easy subject to convey examples of. But I do write about this sort of stuff a lot on my blog. So if you're really interested in this stuff and you hadn't read my blog or you haven't read the stuff I've been writing at Adventure Gamers, you may be interested in those.
Where might we be able to find those things, Benjamin? Just,
you can go to ben304.blogspot.com, and that has links to the Adventure Gamer stuff as well.
I see. And if people wanted to follow you on Twitter, where might they look?
They could look at ben_304. And if they wanted to follow you, Francisco, where would they look?
Well, they would look at Grundislav Games. And if they wanted to follow our podcast, they would look at
At BCT underscore podcast.
All right. Well, that was a lovely discussion, and thanks for listening. And we'll
thank you again for the topic suggestion. And if you've got any more topic suggestions, let us know because we're always interested.
Yes, we are, and sometimes we have trouble coming up with topics on our own. So, thanks for that. Anyway, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Well, start up the tractor and slap your mama's behind. It's time for another episode of Deliverance. You know what I hate, Cletus?
What do you hate, Bubba?
I hate it when these goddarn podcasters don't update their goddarn podcast thread on the AGS forums. I mean, it's been episode 82 for the past year and a half. What's that all about?
I don't know, but you know who I blame.
Who's that?
All darn communists.
That's right. I blame them too. Hey, Cletus. Hey, you want to help me? You want to help me clean my shotgun?
I don't know which end I'm standing on.
Hey, let me point it over. Hoo-hoo-ee!